Okay, today's podcast in the form of a guide with Andrew Perriman is a bit different. It's more academic, a bit more heady than some of the podcasts that we do. But I have confidence in you. You can do it, so stick with it. There's some good payoff coming, and this is just part one of two-part conversation. Part two will drop next week.
Hello, my name is Andrew Perriman. I'm an Associate Research Fellow at the London School of Theology. I'm here today to talk about my book, which is called In the Form of a God, The Pre-Existence of the Exalted Christ in Paul.
Dr. Andrew Perriman, it is so good to see you. Thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure, David.
Yes, I've read some of your stuff, and I know you're a blogger, and you do a number of things. Earlier, you said you worked with a mission organization that's out of the States. Terrific. I look forward to the day we can meet face-to-face. But we're here to talk about your book. But before we do that, for those who don't know Andrew Perriman, who is Andrew Perriman?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question. Thank you. I think I'm primarily a writer, I think, rather than a teacher. I do a fair bit with the London School of Theology now, but we've moved around the world over sort of our careers, my wife and her work. So the opportunities for teaching were limited, but a certain amount of pastoral work in various parts of the world. And I've done quite a lot, as you alluded to, with a mission organization called Communitas, mainly in Europe. But that's been an interesting, to have these sort of two worlds to inhabit and then try and work out, well, what happens between them? Trying to do mission, particularly in the European context, after that, you know, centuries, millennia of Christian Europe, how do we do mission now?
Well, you have contributed greatly to our understanding and are contributing to that of Christology by writing this book. The title of the book is called In the Form of a God, The Pre-Existence of the Exalted Christ. It's part of a series that I edit along with Mike Bird and Scott Hauer called Studies in Early Christology. You're looking at things in fresh ways and interesting ways, in ways a little bit that kind of goes against the grain of where some scholars are in terms of understanding, in Paul at least, if there is truly pre-existence, and in what sense would that mean? And you ask a lot of the right questions there in the opening chapter. So if you could summarize it, what is the big idea of your book, In the Form of a God?
Well, yes, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? Because if you set out to address the question of, did Paul think that Jesus pre-existed? That's not so much a big idea. You're just asking a question, what sort of answer do we get out of it? You can sort of get to the answer. I mean, obviously, some people get there very quickly. You can take a long time to get there. I didn't want it just to be about this question of pre-existence. I come at this from an interest, I mean, I already mentioned that sort of very big narrative that we tell about the life and the mission of the church over the centuries. But more particularly, much of what I've done in the past has been on New Testament eschatology. So it's thinking, well, what is the story that Jesus thought he was part of? I mean, what has brought them to that point, and where is it going next? The same for Paul, the same for Revelation, the whole of the New Testament. So that's where I come from. So then, I mean, I think if there is a big idea, it has to do with the relationship between Christology and eschatology, and somewhat turning that on its head and giving eschatology the priority in this. Whereas from the perspective of the tradition, various sort of theological traditions, we are more likely to begin with Christology assume that somehow eschatology is an account over time of the implications of the Christology. For personal reasons, as you know, this is my personal approach to the thing, but I think for good New Testament reasons, good biblical studies reasons, it makes sense to ask, well, what is Paul saying about Jesus with an overarching storyline in view? So, I mean, I made that point in the introduction that Gordon Fee makes his you know, in terms of thinking about the person of Jesus, this is about the person of Jesus. And then the first thing you think about is salvation. You know, this is what the person of Jesus and the mission of Jesus was all about. My approach, and I say this, is, well, actually, my core presupposition would not be that. It would be that Paul expected something to happen in the future that would dramatically, radically change the shape of his world. So, you know, then ask, well, okay, let's approach this question more from that point of view.
Is there a sense in which that event or those events had already happened for Paul? Because he does talk about new creation. We're living in this new creation. So yeah. Is that just future or is that present in a sense? Is there sort of a realized eschatology in Paul?
Yeah, I mean, okay, there was a couple of things there.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, that's big.
Those are the big ideas. Yeah, exactly.
No, that is big. I think kingdom is more important, much more important to Paul. I mean, he doesn't use kingdom of God language in the same way that Jesus does, or to the extent. Yeah. Clearly.
But he does talk about life, and he talks about abundant life, life in the Spirit, those kind of things. It seems to me he still uses that kingdom language sometimes. But at other times, he talks a lot about life and entering into life, and not to the extent that John does in eternal life phrases and such.
No, I mean, from Paul's point of view, everything that comes into that category is in anticipation of. So one of my, I mean, I've written on Romans and the book on the coming of the Son of Man. I mean, I take the view that Jesus' horizon, if you like, is what's going to happen to Jerusalem. And the temple. So that so much of what Jesus has to say makes sense within that particular horizon. I think for Paul, he's aware of that, but I think he's looking beyond that to the impact of the resurrection and the exaltation of Jesus, the impact that will have on the world that he sees when he takes that gospel message out into the Greek and Roman world, potentially as far as Spain. So he programmatically from Jerusalem, from one end of the empire to the other. There is very much in Paul's mind this view that he is taking this proclamation about a future outworking of the implications and the significance of not just the resurrection. It's not just about life. It's life for the purpose of kingdom. So that the one who is raised from the dead is seated at the right hand of the Father, and therefore, you know, has been given the authority to judge and rule over the nations. You know, everything that has happened and that is working itself out in the experience of the apostles, in the experience of the churches, is for the sake of some sort of future consummation that I think he's thinking in more political terms than in final renewal of creation in the sense that we see it at the end of Revelation.
Yeah.
So I think he takes very seriously the circumstances of God's people in the Greek and Roman world, and he's looking for that whole situation to be turned on its head. A judgment on the pagan system, a judgment on idolatry, you know, that's there in the beginning of Romans. I think Luke picks up on it in Acts 17. And instead, the nations of the Greek and Roman world, the nations of the oikumene, will confess Jesus as Lord. So I tend to think, I mean, this is not a widely accepted view, and I recognize that. Mm-hmm. But I think we can be as realistic about Paul's eschatology in that sort of historical sense as we can about Jesus, not denying that there is, you know, something beyond in a final universal renewal of creation sense, but that Paul, like Jesus, like the prophets, has his focus, his eyes on a somewhat nearer horizon.
The theopolitical horizon,
yes,
in a sense. So it's about God and politics, God and kingdom, more so than politics.
Yes, and so looking back on it from where we are, you know, we might want to say, and you have to sort of approach this rather carefully, that the conversion of the Roman Empire in historical terms, which is a very messy reality always, is that fulfillment of the recognition that the God of Israel, the God who created all things, has given to his Son that supreme authority over the nations.
And that authority given, is that given at the resurrection, at the exaltation? Is that given at the eschaton and in the final things?
I think it's there with the exaltation to the right hand of the Father. I guess when Israel's king is seated at the right hand of the Father, and given this is Psalm 110 or it's Psalm 2, he receives the nations as an inheritance, or sit at my right hand until, you know, so there's a future prospect there. Mm-hmm. Certain things will work out in the course of this reign. Paul uses that idea in 1 Corinthians 15 very clearly. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the basic approach I take. So then sort of come back and look at this question, these quite key texts that have been used to demonstrate in an argument for the pre-existence of Jesus in Paul's mind, look at those texts again and see if they look any differently in the light of that sort of narrative.
That story,
Yes, because I think the eschatology in Paul's mind is actually, let me say this carefully, but I think the eschatology is more significant than the Christology almost. At least he's doing other things with Christology than trying to sort of understand the relationship between the Son and the Father.
Right.
What he's concerned about is, well, what does this relationship have to do? How is that going to play out in the future?
I see. Very interesting. So you look at a number of texts here in the book. Early on, you look at the sending of the Son text.
Right.
And very quickly, sort of what's your approach on that? When it says God, in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born of the law, etc. How do you look at those texts? The sending of the Son.
Very briefly, I mean, part of it is in the fullness of time. And if you sort of go back to the beginning of Galatians, you have that phrase, you know, this reference to the present evil age.
Right.
So part of my argument, there's a tendency to think that the present evil age is sort of human history because humanity is sort of subject to evil. We sin and everything else. Hmm. I think Paul is thinking in much narrower terms of the present evil age that Israel is going through. Under Roman occupation, since Antiochus Epiphanes, so since the Europeans, the Greeks and the Romans have come in and made life extremely difficult for his people, and his people haven't done a particularly good job of dealing with that. That would be the focus. So that in the fullness of time, partly bound up with all what's happening with the law. So that doesn't sort of particularly take a point of a broader universal framework for this. So I think the time frame is quite narrow. He's looking at, well, what has God done at this time? And then it just seems to me, look at the use of the language there, the sending out language is so widely anticipated. There's plenty of that in scripture and elsewhere, mm-hmm. in Greek text, Jewish Greek text. You send out the prophets, you send out the king to do something, you send out the Moses in particular, mm-hmm. the same word, ex apostello. So I think it's, you know, the thought there is that Jesus has been sent to Israel at the right moment to rescue Israel from the catastrophe that is coming upon it in this present evil age.
So the analogy would be closer to God sending Moses. Moses is sent to do this thing, rather than as a pre-existent being who enters into the world and has this mission that is very eschatologically kingdom-focused.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. And in the argument in Galatians, that's relevant, obviously, because he's in being sent out. He's bringing to an end the rule of the law over his people, which began with the sending out of Moses. But, I mean, the other point to make there, David, is one of the core ideas in the book is to sort of keep in mind that Paul is saying these things in the context of a mission to around the Aegean, Asia Minor and around the Aegean and Greek cities. And he's proclaiming to people a resurrected Lord, a spirit figure, someone who exists, is invisible in heaven, a spirit body in heaven. So for Gentiles especially, but also for Jews, they are coming to believe in someone who, we don't begin with the human person. They begin with the spirit. And that's what Galatians is all about. You begin with the spirit. You worship a Lord who has been revealed to Paul himself from heaven. They encountered the same risen Lord. They experienced their relationship with the risen Christ is experienced through the spirit. There are reasons why he needs to sort of fill in the backstory to that. One is to connect it with the story of Israel, clearly, because it's being challenged by whoever these Judaizers are. He needs to account for the fact that he is saying that all this is going to come about through a persecuted and executed Messiah figure. And he needs to talk about suffering, the apostles' experience of suffering and the church's experience of suffering, and to tell them that, well, Jesus went through this first. So although he is, you're meeting him, you're encountering him, you're calling out to him, and perhaps even in some sense worshiping him, all this is a spirit figure who is now seated at the right hand of God, but he was born of a woman. Hmm. He was born under the law. He started where you are. So I think that's part of it. And then the Romans passage, that sort of similar Romans passage where he talked about being in the likeness of sinful flesh. I think, again, the contrast is, well, perhaps it's slightly different in this case, but it's still looking back from that perspective rather than trying to sort of what came before. Mm-hmm. And I argue in the book that Paul is reflecting on the fact that the Jews looked on him as a sinner, this likeness of sinful flesh. So it's not, the contrast is not so much with an ideal pre-existence in mm-hmm. heaven, but this, if you're going to send a Messiah, why is God sending one who is being executed as a sinner?
It's so deeply flawed, yeah.
Someone like that. And I think there are ideas in the wisdom literature that I think sort of help us understand that.
Right.
And the righteous man who suffers is persecuted and looks like, is dismissed by everyone as a sinner.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Perriman about his book, In the Form of a God, The Preexistence of the Exalted Christ in Paul. We're going to do another podcast, so stick around. We've talked a little bit about his approach and a little bit about particularly the language of the sending of the Son and where that fits in, but we're going to look now more specifically at an important part of the book that is in Philippians 2, what is sometimes referred to as the Christ hymn. He's had a different perspective on that. So hang around, wait with us. But Dr. Perriman, thanks for being with us on part one of this interview.
One of the things I love about doing these podcasts is that inevitably I learned something, whether I wanted to or not. And today I did, and I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. For more info about our guest, check out our show notes. They're there for you. Subscribe to the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a comment. Rate us. You know the drill. We're on Apple and Google and Spotify and iHeartRadio and Stitcher and other places. I want to say thanks to those that make this podcast possible, for Kathy Capes, Jocelyn Solis, Phil Kagi, and the Lanier Foundation. Let's give it up for them. Cue the applause track. Thanks for listening.